Welcome back to the Iron Age, friends, and welcome to the last episode of Season 1. Well, the last proper episode. The last narrative episode. Before we fully jump into today's somewhat gruesome episode, I'd like to say thank you. This first season has been a blast. It's reminded me how much I love this subject and has given me space to do my very favourite thing, nerd out about what it means to be human. Our next episode, the first inter-series special, will tie up all the themes and concepts we've explored this season and try and provide some sort of answer to that question. What does it mean to be human? What does British prehistory tell us about the human experience? But before we get there, we need to add the last piece of our historic mosaic. Over this series, we've been to Wales and we've been to Scotland. We've been to the most southerly of coasts and to the most northerly of islands. I've aimed to cover as much of the country as possible in the space of 13 episodes. We've also spoken about many aspects of human life, good and bad. We've spoken about childhood, marriage, death. We've sought to understand cannibalism and headhunting. We've discussed feasting, travel, warfare, hierarchy and economics. It's been a rampant rampage across British prehistory. We've also learnt a lot about the Iron Age specifically. We've learnt that it was a time of hyper-regionality. Britain was a patchwork quilt of competing communities using small-scale raids to maintain a tentative equilibrium. We've also learnt that for most of the Iron Age, from 2600 to 2100 years ago, society was relatively egalitarian. The economy was localised and small-scale. Trade only began to develop at the same time as hierarchies became established. Undoubtedly, the two are interlinked. The Iron Age was a violent time, and as we've seen, religion didn't do much to help. Indeed, it actively promoted pretty brutal acts like headhunting. Today, we're learning more about that religion. For those of you who've been with me for a long time, you'll know what's coming up. Today, to close things out, it's a double header, two fascinating headline-grabbing elements of the late Iron Age: human sacrifice and the Druids. We're going to northwest England, a region I've barely mentioned. This region of England is blessed by a glut of excellent football clubs and cursed by too much rain and by being on the wrong side of the Pennines, the line of hills keeping the Scousers and Mancunians out of the promised land of West Yorkshire. Centuries of rain have created miles and miles of peat bogs in northwest England. It's the same landscape that fills so much of West Scotland. Don't worry, I've already got my peaty podcast whiskey next to me. It is here, 2,000 to 1,900 years ago, as Rome was beginning to force its way up this sceptred isle, that a man was laid to rest in the peat bogs of Cheshire. Like many people buried in bogs, the body of Lindo Man, or Pete Marsh as the press dubbed him, was found in excellent condition. His body bore witness to a brutal death. He was poisoned, throttled, smashed, stabbed, drowned, and eventually left for dead, face down in a bog. Answers to how he died immediately began to swirl. Was he murdered? Executed? Was he slain in battle? Or was he perhaps a sacrifice? And if he was, who had done the sacrificing and why? Let's go and meet Pete Marsh, or Lindo Man, and see if we can answer some of those questions. Needless to say, be warned, this episode deals with some very adult themes. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. The year is 1984. The place is Lindo Moss, a peat bog near Wilmslow, Cheshire, where all the stars of Manchester United, Man City, Liverpool and Everton live. It's a swanky place now, but back in the 80s, Lindo Moss was home to a commercial peat-cutting operation. Two men were working, sorting the peat into something more than piles of half-rotted gunk. One of them pulled out a piece of wood and threw it at his friend. The man who had been hit shrieked in surprise because when the piece of wood landed on the floor, it didn't look so much like wood anymore. It looked like a human foot. This caused a sensation. The archaeologists quickly found most of the rest of the body and soon established the body was at least 1,000 years old, probably older, which kept the police out of proceedings. He was quickly preserved, and initial findings revealed that his death had been a brutal one. He had been throttled, then hit in the back of the head, stabbed repeatedly, before his half-throttled throat was slit and he was thrown into a peat bog, face down. Lindo Mannell, Pete Marsh, grabbed the nation's attention, a murder case 2,000 years in the making. But wait, this wasn't as much of a surprise as you might think. You see, Pete Marsh wasn't the first bog body found in Lindo Moss. A year before, in 1983, another bog body, a skull missing a jawbone dubbed Lindo 1, had been pulled from the same marsh. This turned out to be a woman who had died in 250 CE. However, as we discussed last time, the police get the first call on any human body discovered in the UK. They were very interested in a well-preserved skull found in a bog near Wilmslow. For 20 years, they'd had their suspicions about a local man whose wife had disappeared in the 1960s. He had strenuously denied any knowledge of her disappearance, and with no other evidence, the case had gone cold. The discovery of the skull, though, gave the police a reason to go and ask some very pointed questions. In the face of this new evidence, the murderer crumbled, and despite withdrawing his confession when the ancient dates came through, he was finally convicted of murdering his wife. Lindo Moss, then, is an environment that preserves bodies so well that even 1,750 years later, they look like they're only a few years deceased. Lindo Moss is part of the same string of peat bogs that run throughout northwestern Europe, Ireland, North England, Scotland, the Western Isles, Orkney, Germany, and Scandinavia. The reason marshes like these are so effective at preservation is because of a clever little moss called sphagnum. The moss often makes up over 90% of the vegetation in a peat bog. The walls of this moss are filled with lignin, a material that binds cellulose in plants tightly together, making them resistant to being broken down. It is lignin that makes wood hard and means most organisms can't digest timber. This means that peat bogs are filled with moss that isn't breaking down. Instead, the moss sits there, doing its thing. One of those things that sphagnum moss does is release sugar chemicals to attract calcium and nitrogen, which then prompts the moss to release humic acid. This process reduces the amount of oxygen and increases the acidity of the earth, making the environment inhospitable to almost everything but the sphagnum moss and amphibious creatures like this podcast's spirit animal, the marvellous water vole, which have a thriving community in Lindo Marsh. Listen to episode 1 of this series to find why these animals are so very special. When a human is placed into these soils, two things happen. First of all, the sphagnum moss special sugar chemicals pulls out the calcium and nitrogen from the bones, making them soft. The humic acid will eventually, after about 250 years, completely erase these mushy bones. The second thing is that the same humic acid that dissolves the bones denatures the proteins that make up all of our organs, our skin, liver, heart and hair, our lungs, our eyes and our lips. This means that the creepy crawlies that turn us all eventually into dust can't eat the proteins that make us up. Which is pretty much the same process cow skin goes through to become leather.
Yes, science!
Many cultures residing in northwestern Europe have taken advantage of the bogs to dispose of their dead for many different reasons. For example, in Ireland, it appears that it was nobles who were buried in bogs. We think this because many Irish bog bodies have their nipples sliced off. In Celtic Ireland, people showed their submission to kings by sucking their nipples. Seriously, I'm not joking. I checked 3 or 4 sources to make sure this is the case, and it checks out. In Iron Age Ireland, a new king would bare his chest, and supplicant after supplicant would come and suckle the king's nipple. When a king died or was overthrown, their nipples may have been cut off, either wholly or partially, to prevent people showing submission to these people, ensuring they had to show submission to whoever was currently in charge. It has also been suggested that the bog bodies of northwestern Europe might be buried in bogs that marked important boundaries or that were wildernesses used for disposing of criminals who had been physically expelled from the community. They were outside spaces, edge places. It is also widely posited that these are the bodies of those given up for human sacrifice. All of which we'll come to in a second or two. However, before diving into the theories as to what is going on and why, let me properly introduce you to Lindo Mann. Let's start with when he died to put this story into the context of this season's wider narrative. Whilst initial radiocarbon datings confirmed that he was definitely over 1,000 years old, later more detailed dating revealed that he died somewhere between 2 BCE and 119 CE. However, I think he probably died before 77 CE. Why that specific date? Well, because that's the date that the Romans finally crushed the last holdout of the Druids in Anglesey, which isn't too far from Cheshire. He died at the very end of the Iron Age, or the very beginning of the Romano-British period, depending on how you define things. At the time of his death, the Romans were working their way up the island. The entire south of England was pacified, Yorkshire was under Roman control, and Boudicca had just been crushed. However, in Wales, Northumbria, Scotland, and northwest England, this wasn't a Romanized world. It was still very much a Celtic Iron Age. What about Lindow Man's remains? What do we have there? Well, only about half his body and a leg. Obviously, we've got one of his feet. Unfortunately, though, it appears that before he was discovered, a JCB cut through the bottom half of his body and scooped away the rest. That said, though, it has been suggested that Lindow 4, the most recent human remains found in Lindow Marsh, might be the missing pieces of Lindow Man. But that's unproven, and so we'll proceed with what we know. We've got a torso, a head, and the bottom part of a leg. He is, as I'm sure you've gathered, exceptionally well preserved. There'll be an image of him on Instagram to show you exactly what he looked like. However, for our purposes now, you need to know that he was found entirely naked, save for a fox fur armband wrapped around his left bicep. Lindow Man was in his mid-20s when he died, and he would have stood, when alive, somewhere between 168 and 173 centimetres, or for the Americans out there, between 5'6" and 5'8". He would have weighed around 60 kilos or 9.5 stone. His hair was neatly cut, his beard short and well-groomed. His teeth were in excellent condition with no cavities, and his nails were well cared for and showed little signs of wear, all of which suggests that this slight man had a noble pedigree. But he wasn't quite as healthy as it initially seems. He was already beginning to develop a little bit of osteoarthritis, and his gut was infected with whipworm and mawworm. This means that, although he had a good upbringing and was probably unfamiliar with hard work, his back would have ached and he may have suffered from helminthiasis, which could have caused issues ranging from malnutrition and anemia to reduced fertility and lowered cognitive function. Nor does his diet in the last days of his life speak to a noble upbringing. He had mistletoe pollen in his stomach, a poisonous berry associated with druidic rituals. His last meal was one of charred bread, a griddle cake similar to that which King Alfred famously burned whilst plotting his comeback campaign against the Vikings. But that's for next season. Finally, his injuries. These are numerous and unpleasant. Working from the head down, the first injury come across is a fracture on the back of his skull. This is consistent with being hit hard by an axe. The blow didn't just break bone, but it would have forced thick fragments of skull deep into his brain. Next, his throat had been garrotted, a piece of rope had been squeezed tightly around his neck, choking him. This news probably acted as a tourniquet, stemming the blood flow and extending his agony as his throat was cut. Then he was stabbed multiple times in the chest before finally being laid to rest in a shallow grave, cut from the peat. He was face down, as though drowned in the peat bog. He was then a man with a good upbringing and a terrible end. His slight size and undamaged fingernails suggest he was a man who had grown up never needing to work very hard. That good life ended. In the months before he died, he was left to stew, preventing him from exercising and causing his frame to wither and picking up some foul parasites along the way. He was fed a poisonous and nutritious diet and was then murdered in a complex, drawn-out process. All of which is brutal and terrible. The question is, why would anyone do something so vicious and over the top? Unsurprisingly, Lindow Man has prompted much discussion and many theories. We'll talk about those next. No one thinks Lindow Man died by accident. He didn't trip and fall into a bog, nor did he somehow stumble into some soggy Iron Age version of Madame Trunchbull's chokey. Lindow Man was killed by someone. But why? Some shallow and overexcited readers of the evidence suggest that Lindow Man had been ambushed while walking through the isolated bog. He was stripped naked, robbed, murdered, and then hidden in the mush of Lindow Moss. They suggest his griddle cakes were a burned travel meal, infected with mistletoe pollen from the trees he camped under whilst making his last dinner. Other people see this as an execution. They say that Lindo Moss, the peat bog, was a border and that this man had committed some terrible crime and was killed at the very edge of the territory, ostracizing him and expelling him from the community he'd known all of his life. Both of these ideas have their merits. A different podcaster would lovingly detail all the evidence for each of these ideas. They may even argue that one of them is definitely correct. As we've learned in almost every episode this season, nothing is definite in archaeology. Everything can be pulled apart and disagreed upon. But you're not listening to a different podcaster. You're listening to me. And I think Lindo Man was an example of human sacrifice. His death is too elaborate. It was too protracted to suggest murder. Murder takes minutes, and from what we know of Lindo Man, his death took hours. Don't worry, though. We're not going to leave it there and jump straight to druids. Let me spell out why I think we have human sacrifice. The first is the over-the-top killing. He was killed in multiple ways. There is a debate as to whether the blow to his head was caused before death or due to the peat pushing down on his softened skull. However, even without that blow, Lindo Man was killed in at least three ways: strangulation, stabbing, and throat slitting. Four, if you include the fact he was placed face down in a bog, suggesting he was either symbolically or actually drowned. Five, if you follow some analysts, into believing he was poisoned by mistletoe before he was killed. This is too extravagant for murder, as we've mentioned. However, it's also probably too much for simple criminal execution. Most executions, even ritualized ones, kill people quickly. Death is the punishment. This is the case with the few countries who still think it's cool to murder their own citizens. The Americans inject people with a fast-acting poison. The Iranians hang people, which seeks to break the person's neck, killing them immediately. Other recent execution methodologies include shooting, electric chair, or guillotine. All of these ways are industrialized, predictable, quick, and quote-unquote merciful. Beheading was the most common method, and it was expected by most societies that it was right to behead a condemned individual as cleanly and as quickly as possible. I racked my brains before writing this to see what examples of ancient executions I could think of which had a similar level of brutality to that of Lindo Man, and definitely happened. I came up with three categories: the medieval practice of hanging, drawing and quartering, stoning, crucifying or burning, and the Roman punishment of decimation. However, whilst all these methods of execution are needlessly brutal, they are deliberately so. First of all, consider hanging, drawing and quartering. This brutal and literally medieval process involved hanging the condemned individual until half dead. They were then cut down and, while still alive, had the organs removed and burnt over a brazier in front of them. Finally, they were cut into parts, literally quartered, and those body parts were sent to different parts of the country to be displayed as a warning to others. That's the critical part for me: the warning. This method of execution is almost exclusively reserved for treason, the singularly worst crime someone could commit in a fragile and self-conscious monarchy. The over-the-top death was meant as a lesson. It served a greater purpose than simply removing a criminal from society. Other over-the-top, unnecessary execution methods also have secondary purposes. Take stoning, crucifying, or burning. Stoning and burning were punishments for extreme blasphemy or heresy. They were highly public, drawn-out executions. Before the execution took place, the crimes of the condemned would be read out, and the agony was deliberate to show how horrible it was to betray God. Especially with burning at the stake, it brought a little piece of hell into public view and reminded people of how important it was to stay on God's merciful side. Crucifixion was a Roman practice for punishing rebels. The Romans didn't kill Jesus because he was preaching blasphemy in the Jewish faith, but because he was one of a number of prophets in the 1st century CE and BCE, causing a ruckus in Palestine, destabilizing an already troubled province. The Romans reacted with their customary brutality. We see this again after the rebellion of Spartacus, when the miserable bodies of his army were hung on crosses along the Via Appia from Capua to Rome, a body every 300 metres for 200 kilometres along Rome's most important road. The deaths weren't just awful, they were cautionary. Another Roman practice that was exceedingly awful, but which also served a greater purpose, was decimation. When a Roman legion did something particularly horrendous, whether that was showing cowardice or mutinying, the last resort, the most vile practice a Roman general could command, was decimation. The cohorts were divided into groups of 10 men, and they would draw straws. The man who literally drew the short straw was condemned to death. However, he wasn't beheaded or hanged. Instead, he was beaten to death by his comrades. This allowed a commander to punish a large group of soldiers whilst only killing 10% of them. Again, the reason for this overly violent murder of these men wasn't to punish the victim, but to affect those around him, quite literally, his comrades. So across cultures, regions and times, there is a tendency towards more extravagant executions only when there is a powerful secondary reason for the person to be killed. These secondary reasons fall into two camps. Either a crime against the society or government the person finds themselves in, or a crime against the spiritual beliefs or religion of that society or government. I'm not opposed to Lindo Man being a criminal who was executed. However, there is, in my mind at least, definitely a secondary reason for his execution. I believe that secondary reason is as a human sacrifice. This is supported by the situation in which Lindo Man was left. He was naked, save for a fox fur armband. This is an odd way to find a body. From every other Iron Age burial we have in the UK, there is at least some evidence of clothing, either armour, belt buckles or brooches. The fact he was naked with a very strange adornment suggests a degree of ritualisation. This is supported by his strange diet. Every other bit of evidence we have suggests Lindo Man had a good diet for most of his life, save for the occasional bout of malnutrition when he was a teenager, which was probably associated with famines. To find only charred bread in his stomach is weird enough, but to find unleavened charred bread with mistletoe is strange and mysterious, especially when considered in line with his naked body and the odd place of his death. In the Iron Age, peat bogs were larger and less out of the way, but that doesn't mean they were a common place to find people. As we see with Irish bog bodies and Ireland's strangely persistent borders, it's quite common in other cultures for bog bodies to be buried in peat bogs that mark the boundary between two communities. This is an idea we've seen in the UK too. The long and round barrows of Wessex and the chamber tombs of Orkney have all been linked to acting as territorial boundaries. And finally, there's the fact that people wrote about Celtic and Germanic cultures sacrificing humans. Caesar wrote of the Gauls 100 years or so before Lindo Man's death, quote, "The Gauls believe the power of the immortal gods can be appeased only if one human life is exchanged for another, and they have sacrifices of this kind regularly established by the community. Some of them have enormous images made of wicker work, the limbs of which they fill with living men. These are set on fire and the men perish, enveloped in flames." End quote. Other writers talk about sacrifices that seem strikingly similar to that of Lindo Man. Strabo, another Roman author, says, quote, "They, the Celts, used to strike a man whom they had devoted to death in the back with a knife, and then divine the future from his death throes. But they did not sacrifice without a druid." End quote. And he's backed up by Diodorus Siculus, who says, quote, "They assembled the prisoners and carried out an act of extreme barbarity and utter insolence. They took those who were most handsome and in strength and flower of their youth, and having crowned them, sacrificed them to the gods." Tacitus speaks directly to Iron Age Britons using human sacrifice for religious reasons when he says, quote, "They deemed it a duty, indeed, to cover their altars with the blood of captives and to consult their deities through human entrails." This is strikingly reminiscent of how Tacitus, the same author, describes the site of the Battle of Teutoburg Forest in Germany, 6 years after Varus had lost the legions. Quote, "In the centre of the field were the whitening bones of men as they had fled or stood their ground, strewn everywhere or piled in heaps. Near lay fragments of weapons and limbs of horses, and also human heads prominently nailed to trunks of trees. In the adjacent groves were the barbarous altars on which they had immolated tribunes and the first rank centurions." End quote. Admittedly, it's all very dramatic. Teutoburg was the Roman equivalent of Dunkirk or D-Day, and Tacitus was something of a first century Spielberg, telling a very true story in a highly dramatised way. It rings true though, especially since the archaeology and history are playing so nicely together. Even if the Romans are being typically overdramatic, their accounts hint at the identity of Lindo Man. Diodorus is explicit, quote, "And in pursuance of their savage ways, they manifest an outlandish impiety with their sacrifices. For their criminals, they keep prisoner for 5 years and then impale them in honour of their gods." Caesar agrees, quote, "They, the Gauls, believe that the gods prefer it if the people executed have been caught in the act of theft or armed robbery or some other crime. But when the supply of such victims runs out, they even go to the extent of sacrificing innocent men." End quote. What all this is saying is that potentially the competing theories that Lindo Man was a human sacrifice or an execution are both right. Perhaps he was a nobleman who had tried to overthrow the ruler and was thus sentenced for execution. Or perhaps he was a prisoner of war. Either way, rather than simply executing him, it appears that the people of Iron Age Cheshire may have held on to him, feeding him poor quality food like burnt bread, before finally executing him in a highly ritualized way, potentially on the border he had dared to cross with violence in his heart. But why? Why would a person or people kill someone for religious reasons? Well, instead of getting philosophical, that'll come later, let me tell you about an ancient Jewish practice which gives us the word scapegoating. That's an odd word, right? Well, it was customary in ancient Israeli cultures to ritually burden an actual goat with all the sins of the community. On the goat, they'd throw symbols and throw curses at it, and then drive the poor animal out into the wilderness. The goat was presumably quite happy to run away from these strange shouting people and to find a nice bush to chomp on. However, for the Israelis, that fleeing goat took with it the sins and worries of the community, a literal scapegoat. This is the purpose of sacrifice. It involves giving up something useful or important, and in return the universe, or God, gives you something in return, usually security or prosperity. It isn't surprising to find Lindo Man a sacrifice on a probable border. His location suggests why he was sacrificed, to ask the gods to protect or shore up a border during a time of worry. This is how I imagine him at any rate, a prisoner of war captured and sentenced to death. He was killed at an important border as, from the south, a new people, the Romans, began to murder their way up the island. As tensions rose, drastic action was needed, and so this captive, a living memory of a previous victory, was used as a sacrifice to the gods who watched over the land and the sacred borders of this Iron Age community. Watching over this sacrifice, perhaps conducting and interpreting the sacrificial rites with the Druids, the priests of Iron Age Britain. Let's find out more about who these people were. Caesar says, quote, "The Druids are engaged in things sacred. They conduct the public and private sacrifices and interpret all matters of religion. To these Druids, a large number of the young men resort for the purpose of instruction, and the Druids are in great honour among them, for they determine respecting almost all controversies, public and private, and if any crime has been perpetrated, if murder has been committed, if there be any dispute about an inheritance, if any about boundaries, these same persons decide it. And if anyone, either in a private or public capacity, has not submitted to their decision, they interdict him from the sacrifices. This, among them, is the most heavy punishment. Those who have been thus indicted are esteemed in the number of those impious and the criminal. All shun them, and avoid their society and conversation, lest they receive some evil from their contact. Nor is justice administered to them when seeking it, nor is any dignity bestowed on them. This institution is supposed to have been devised in Britain and to have been brought over from it into Gaul, and now those who desire to gain a more accurate knowledge of that system generally proceed thither for the purpose of studying it. The Druids do not go to war nor pay tribute together with the rest. They have an exemption from military service and a dispensation in all matters. Induced by such great advantages, many embrace this profession of their own accord, and many are sent to it by their parents and relations. They are said there to learn by heart a great number of verses. Accordingly, some remain in the course of training 20 years. Nor do they regard it lawful to commit these to writing, though in almost all of the matters, in their public and private transactions, they use Greek characters. That practice they seem to me to have adopted for two reasons, because they neither desire their doctrines to be divulged among the mass of the people, nor those who learn to devote themselves the less to the efforts of memory, relying on writing, since it generally occurs to most men that, in their dependence on writing, they relax their diligence in learning thoroughly, and their employment of their memory. They wish to inculcate this as one of their leading tenets, that souls do not become extinct, but pass after death from one body to another, and they think that men by this tenet are in a great degree excited to valour, the fear of death being thus disregarded. They likewise discuss and impart to the youth many things respecting the stars and their motion, respecting the extent of the world and of our earth, respecting the nature of things, respecting the power and the majesty of the immortal gods." End quote. The Druids, in Caesar's estimation and in the public opinion ever since, are priests, divinators, judges, teachers, and walking repositories of all the knowledge held by Celtic society. Unfortunately, none of that survives in the archaeological record, and to the Druids, Caesar gives many of the functions that sat at the heart of Roman society: lawyers, priests, and teachers. Caesar is also notoriously guilty of over-dramatization and oversimplification. What does the archaeology tell us about the Druids? Well, nothing that matches exactly with the detail of the written sources. The image we get from the Romans is of a highly centralized class who tied together an otherwise disparate culture. To Tacitus, Diodorus, and Caesar, the Druids create and maintain the principles and practices that sit at the heart of what it means to be a Celt. Unfortunately, we don't see that in the archaeological record. That's not to say the Druids didn't exist. Lindow Man is just one of a number of bog bodies and strange burials in northwestern Europe that fit very closely with the written evidence of human sacrifice, which puts the Druids at the centre of such activity. The only direct evidence for Druids in the archaeological record are a number of burials all across Britain and France, which are buried with a range of strange objects. These can be put into four categories: spoons, mirrors, clothes, and specialist objects. Importantly, though, there's no clear sexual preference. According to archaeology, Druids could be male or female. Now, let's get to those spoons. You might want to pause this episode and go and hit me up on Instagram for this bit. These spoons aren't for eating soup. They're far, far fancier than that. These spoons come in pairs. Each spoon is oval, with the far end coming to a sharp point, the handle being at the other end. That handle is ornate, short and horizontal. These Iron Age spoons are made of a reflective metal, copper, gold, bronze. One spoon is decorated by a cross engraved lightly into the metal. The other spoon is plain, save for a tiny hole either in the centre or one corner of the spoon. These Iron Age spoons are made of a reflective metal like gold or bronze or silver. One spoon is decorated with a cross lightly engraved into its face. The other spoon is plain, save for a tiny hole either in the centre or on one corner of the spoon. We don't know what these spoons were for, however, they're usually interpreted as evidence of the divination so well attested in the written record. The cross shape may refer to the four stages of the moon, and many believe that these spoons were used as predictors of the future. You would ask the druid when something would happen, and they would pour oil or blood into the spoon with the hole and hold the other spoon beneath the hole. As the liquid splattered onto the cross spoon, it would reveal under which phase of the moon said action would take place. It might also be that these spoons were the badge of office of the druids. They were designed to be held on a belt. We're also told by some written sources that the druids tended to wear white gowns, so this gives us an image of the druids, wearing white with a belt laden with the tools of their office, such as highly ornate magical spoons. Another potential badge of office, another object which gives us an insight into druidic beliefs, are the mirrors we sometimes find. The mirrors we find date to the late Iron Age and early Romanish British time. They're again highly ornate and able to be polished to a high sheen. These mirrors are exceedingly rare, probably because they're expensive and burying them represented a huge destruction of value. They are common enough, though, to suggest they are widespread geographically, but rare enough to suggest that they belong to a very specific class. Of course, these mirrors might be purely for elites to admire their flowing locks and rosy cheeks. However, it's been suggested by more than a few individuals that they're druidic implements. Why? Well, because of two important tenets of druidic belief well attested in many written accounts. The first is the dichotomous nature of the world to the druids. The second is the importance of water and natural places. A second biographer of Greek philosophers captures an ancient opinion that the druids had well-defined philosophical beliefs. Quote, "Some say that the study of philosophy originated with the barbarians, in that among the Persians there existed the Magi, and among the Celts and Gauls men who are called Druids, as Aristotle relates in his book on magic." End quote. This philosophy being discussed has two key elements. The first is the eternity of the human soul. There are parallels here with concepts of nirvana in Buddhism. This idea that during a human life a person may strive for a perfection that will permanently improve their immortal soul. This is the philosophical cause for the glorious nature of warfare in the Iron Age. Victory for the temporal community came secondary to glory for your eternal soul. This also explains why the Druids were famed for not writing things down. As Caesar says, quote, "It generally occurs to most men that in their dependence on writing, they relax their diligence in learning thoroughly and their employment of the memory." End quote. Since it's important for the druids to continually improve their eternal souls, then it was vital they kept developing their memory in the same way that a warrior worked towards glory. This also explains why headhunting was so important. The head, the brain, was the source of memory, of vigour, of your actual soul. To capture someone's head, to display that, was to demonstrate your power over their eternal soul, and thus your power over the other world. Which leads us nicely onto why mirrors were important to druids. They believed that reflections weren't mere echoes of the existing world, but insights into the other world, the shadow world of spirits and souls. It's for this reason that druids also greatly revered lakes and ponds, natural mirrors with hidden depths. They may have seen these deep, mysterious and reflective places as sites where the physical world and the shadow world met. Mirrors then would act as portable ponds and lakes, allowing the druids to consult the other world even when they were away from a body of water or when the British rain hid the reflections from sight. Lakes, ponds and rivers, though, weren't the only or even the most important natural places to druids. No. The most important place for druids were groves, especially of oak and especially groves of oak that contain mistletoe. As Pliny says, quote, "The druids, that is what they call their magicians, hold nothing more sacred than mistletoe and a tree on which it is growing, provided it is Valonia oak. Mistletoe is rare, and when found it is gathered with great ceremony, and particularly on the sixth day of the moon. Hailing the moon in a native word that means healing all things, they prepare a ritual sacrifice and banquet beneath a tree and bring up two white bulls whose horns are bound for the first time on this occasion. A priest arrayed in white vestments climbs the tree and with a golden sickle cuts down the mistletoe, which is caught in a white cloak." End quote. I love this quote. It brings together much of what we've already discussed. The importance of natural sights, the value of mistletoe, the primacy given to the night and to the moon as suggested by their spoons, and of the white clothes which we introduced way back when discussing Danebury. It also provides another cord to our rope of evidence that Lindow Man was sacrificed by druids. The mistletoe pollen we found in his stomach wasn't accidental but deliberate, a vital part of sacrificial rites overseen by druids. This reminds us of a key thing about the Iron Age religion we've discussed previously. It was an animistic, polytheistic faith. Their gods weren't hidden beings. Indeed, the gods were the ancestors of the Celts. They believed that humans literally came from the gods, a deep cultural memory of a belief stretching back to at least the late Neolithic period, 3,000 years before. These gods now occupied the earth in places like peat bogs, but also in the trees, mountains, lakes and streams. The druidic belief of the Iron Age Celts saw the answers to questions about what is real and where do things come from as remarkably simple and somewhat consistent with many of the beliefs of Greek philosophers like Plato and Thales. There were two worlds, and when something happened in one of those worlds, it was reflected in the other world. In one world were solid things, the natural world and human actions. In the other world was the essence of those objects, the gods and the human soul. Humans move between these worlds as they move between life and death. The last type of object which points to the role of druids is that of specialist objects. Pliny tells us that druids used particular instruments for certain tasks, like cutting down mistletoe with a golden sickle. This is obliquely referenced by a number of instruments in some of the burials that have been interpreted as surgical instruments. I don't want to get too bogged down on the meaning of this. Instead, it's notable here because it points to a class of individuals who held many roles within a society. They were well-educated and talented. These people used their abilities to help their communities as it was needed. Yes, for religious rites and divination, but also practical help, such as medical support. We also know how these druids may have looked. Yes, we know they probably often wore white and had at their belt many strange objects, which helped them conduct their many roles and reminded the rest of society of their power. However, we also know that they may have been tonsured. That's right, tonsured, like monks. Well, not exactly like monks as we think of them. You see, there's one burial which had a headdress. Well, more of a headband. The burial also had a sword and a shield, so it was probably to hold back a warrior's long hair during battle. But there is another intriguing possibility. You see, on many handles from the Iron Age, called bucket handles, are strange individuals with a single band of hair along the top of their head. It looks weird, somehow priestly and somehow not. Potentially, these might be depictions of druids with a particularly odd hairstyle. Again, as a way of marking them out as different. Usually, I'd dismiss such flaky evidence and not even put it in here. But then I've been doing a lot of reading about the early medieval Anglo-Saxon or Dark Ages period, a few hundred years after our discussions today. That's because next season is all about the post-Roman period in Britain. Don't forget to subscribe for that. One of the core religious debates in 7th century CE was whether the British church should align with the Roman church. At the centre of that debate were discussions around the dating of Easter, which isn't relevant, and the style of tonsure monks should wear. You see, monks and priests of the British school, which had come from Ireland, had adopted a tonsure which was very different to that of Roman Catholic monks and priests. We don't know the history of this tonsure or how it looked, but there is the tantalising possibility that, like many practices in Christianity, the British and Irish tonsure had been adopted from the pagan priests, the Druids, and kept alive by these new Christian priests. This is far from impossible. Modern festivals like Easter, Christmas, Halloween and Harvest still contain many elements from our pagan past. These cultural memories can be very hard to budge and can last a long, long time. Looking at all the evidence, what we don't have is explicit, objective evidence for Druids as a centralised pseudo-bureaucracy. The image from the archaeological evidence is of a highly respected group of men and women who played a critical religious role. They interpreted signs, conducted sacrifices, and taught the rest of the population about the nature of reality. This wasn't analogous with the Roman priests, but instead was uniquely Celtic. By that I mean it was highly regional, and it was the person who held the power, not the class or objects they belonged to. It's this confusion which explains why Caesar saw them as lawyers and druids. Because a druid held the knowledge and abilities to become a very useful and highly respected individual, many were brought into discussions of policy or of justice. They were often treated as belonging to the ruling class, but sitting outside of day-to-day politics. This allowed them to act as dispute breakers. Critically, though, this wasn't a formalised role for them. Instead, it was a position druids could hope to occupy because of the personal relationships and communal respect they were able to gather because of their religious position. A druid who was hard to work with or quite new would be left out of such discussions. All that said, I could be wrong. It isn't completely out of the realms of possibility that our Roman friends were entirely accurate. If that's the case, then this confusion wouldn't disappoint the Druids. They would not want their knowledge in the hands of people who didn't understand what they knew. That's why they continue to exert such a hold on our imagination. There's so much space to create your own Druids. Feel free, Caesar did. Just don't conflate Druids and Stonehenge. You're better than that. Lindow Man is quite rightly one of the most famous discoveries in modern British archaeology. He, like many bog bodies, is a window into the day-to-day lives of individuals living hundreds and thousands of years ago. We learn that every day was dogged by terror. The world was a violent place with regular bouts of famine. However, the people living in the shadow of those struggles didn't succumb to misery. No, they created a worldview that was beautiful and full of hope. They saw this world as merely the beautiful reflection of a better place. They knew their souls transcended earthly concerns and they could use warfare, politics and economics to improve themselves and their souls. These people aren't barbarians. They're not faceless blue-painted characters. Instead, they're living people with complicated, nuanced relationships with each other and with the world in which they lived. Some of them were warriors, others farmers. Some were priests and others were noble kings. Some, though, broke the rules. They strove to change their world and they failed. That failure to grasp wealth and glory led to brutal consequences. All of that from a half body left in a Cheshire peat bog. Lindow Man reminds us of the power of archaeology not just to understand society and large-scale changes, but to dig right down into the hyper-personal, to look at past people in the face and understand more about their life. That's what this podcast is all about. Archaeology is a subject that allows us to rub away our assumptions or tendencies to see the past as the inevitable march of historical imperatives. The past is instead a never-ending chain of human relationships, trying to make sense of a complicated and sometimes cruel world. Sometimes, images and prose fall short. To end this season, I'd like to share with you my response to researching Lindow Man. He doesn't look like a criminal. Lying there, eyes closed, face darkened by the slow sinking in of thick pigments that made up his peat bog grave. Not a cutting, but a bed. No coffin. Bared to the winds, to the sun, to the rain, to the acid bath that burnt away his bones. Stood here, looking down at eyelids gently closed, a pensive mouth brushed with a smudging of auburn stubble. He doesn't look like a sacrifice. Just a sack. Life squeezed out like air from a freezer bag. Collapsed, formless, shaped by greater forces than those his ancient world ever thought existed. Acids and oxygen, tiny microscopic beasts. A thousand different soups make us all like him. Collapsed, formless, darkened, into earth, into shadow, until we're gone. Stay safe, friends. The world isn't going crazy. Humans are just being human. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. See you soon.